It is time to check in once again with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for another Tacky Talk. Hey, Tacky, how are you?
Good morning, Joe. It's good to see you again this week.
Indeed, and we're approaching the holiday season, so we'll have one more of these chats next week before we have a little break, because I need some time off.
Oh, I didn't realize that I was causing the change in family lifestyle through these weekly chats.
Oh, no, not you. It has nothing to do with you. It's just life in general.
I think our wonderful audience will be able to live a week without us during the holiday break. I'm fairly confident people are not eagerly awaiting my face during the time of holiday.
Well, I mean, if they are, there's plenty of them on our website they can go check out. How have you been coping this past week?
It's been pretty good overall. I mean, very, very busy. We had a hearing on Monday on the so-called alternative therapy body works regulation bill, which lasted just about 3 hours. My co-chair, Sue Moran from Farmer, did a fabulous job, actually, moving through over 60 plus people seeking to testify within the 3-minute limit. As some of you may have experienced through going through local or maybe experienced it through my level of government on public hearings and comment sessions, whatnot. Managing a Zoom type format, particularly in a public hearing where you got plenty of people in the queue trying to get through, it can be very challenging to do so. It's very different from in person where, you know, you can actually see what's in the audience and kind of sort of gauge what's going on. Even if a sign-up sheet process and you have the participant list coming on and off, you know, we're doing a lot of clicking and it's kind of weird because you want to pay attention to folks, but your eyes keep moving around because you're trying to track things on your laptop and, you know, on pieces of paper in front of you. And it gives that false impression sometimes you're not paying attention, which is absolutely not true. So it's a little bit different as opposed to being, you know, in person where I have the sign-up sheets in front of me. People who come in late to sign up can still sign up. You know, the ability to kind of navigate a crowd situation. It's, you know, I've done, what I think we're up to like hearing 17 or 18 at this level, plus another more than half dozen from the prior years, prior session. So, I mean, I've done well into like 25 to almost 30 of these, maybe closing in. I have some more hearings, executive sessions coming up. So still, I'm sorry to say, I'm still not used to doing it in this format. We've gotten good at it through a lot of trial and error, but still very much not used to this format.
Yeah, what is the current status of the State House? I think it was this past Monday was the next phase of reopening was supposed to begin.
Yes, we had my chief of staff in the office on Monday as part of this public hearing process. We still, of course, ran a virtual hearing, and it was just frankly easier to have everyone do it from home than trying to shuffle everyone to the office. And there's also, we discussed the acoustic issue associated with it. So if you're sitting at your desk and you're 3 feet from the person next to you, and you're running virtual hearings, it's kind of a ridiculous view if you think about it. We have people's desks, you know, very close to each other. Everyone's staring at a laptop with headphones on. The optics, you can picture the optics of that. It's almost comedic, given, you know, our virtual mentality of the world. But in terms of operations, it didn't seem very practical. So at this point, the holidays are here. I mean, my staff is looking, obviously, to take time to see the family. Everyone's expending a lot of caution to taking their COVID test before seeing their own family, as well as doing some self-quarantining prior to seeing their family, too. So, you know, my guys are very, very, very cautious about this. And obviously, if anyone gets sick, they're out of work because they're really not well. And that impacts our productivity, too. And given the size of my office of being just five folks, losing, you know, even two of them to a couple of weeks to illness, you know, has enormous impact. It's not like a vacation where, you know, more than one person takes vacation. We can plan around the workload. This isn't a disease, which is like the flu or even a cold, we can be down in less than 5 days. I mean, you know, you could be down 10 plus days, depending on the circumstances, potentially in COVID. So, you know, right now the discussion is that so-called 2B phase, and it's going to be by appointment only, meaning that you have to arrange appointment to the office and go straight to the office and leave after you come to the office. There is a whole contact tracing component. I'm still not sure exactly how we're going to do contact tracing, whether it's my personal responsibility to do so, or does the House actually have a larger contract tracing system set up so that, you know, we kind of have to report to them. I'm not clear on that yet.
Okay.
But there is clearly a move to let limited members of the public in. And I just want to emphasize to everybody, is you guys will go to visit state offices or other types of offices, there is a front door. I mean, whether it be a security check to get your driver's license, we give you a pass to the elevator. There's always a reception desk between you and everybody else. Very few people actually wander past those reception areas. I think at lunch or we use the bathroom, depending on the circumstance of the office. But we don't have those barriers. I mean, I don't even have a front desk reception right now. Actually, most of my career, we've never had one. It's been a staffing issue, always a continuous staffing issue. So people will just wander my office. I've had strangers wander my office in the past. So when you open a building to the public, you're untethered. There is no way to know if you've been there or not. It's like being in self-station, put it that way. That's basically the stay house. You just go from place to place. You can grab anybody in the building you want. And you know, despite metal detectors and things like that, I mean, you know, if you want to tackle me in the state house, there's really nothing stopping you. I know that's kind of an extreme example, but you know, I've had you know, run into folks expressing their opinion. We'll be polite about that. You know, you guys can imagine what that is like, having strangers right up in your face. So it's not quite what you all think it is. We all have this image that it's like security at Congress when you watch Congress and or security at a any other state office where you're standing at a desk with a barrier between you and everybody else. No, we don't have that. And it's not like you guys ever see me running around with like security. It isn't like I have state troopers following me around or anything like that. So, you know, it's a different degree of risk level. I think people don't fully grasp.
Yeah. As I understand it from the House Speaker, there are only four House members that are unvaccinated, and there's, I guess, a series of disciplinary steps if they don't get some kind of an exemption for that.
Well, with the membership, you know, the Speaker can limit their access to the chamber. I mean, obviously, Speaker can try to limit their access to their own offices regarding usage. You know, staff, you know, they're going to try to work with staff as much as possible. Disciplinary action is actually very much a last resort option.
Yeah.
First resort option. And, you know, first resort option, obviously, vaccination. Second resort option is to try to figure out a workplace accommodation that makes sense, whether it remain virtual or not, depending on the type of work you do. So, you know, they're working at it, trying to figure out how to make this work for everybody.
Since last we talked, Techie, the governor did sign the ARPA bill, mostly intact, right?
Yeah, we talked about the number of vetoes. I projected a very low possibility of them vetoing earmarks, which he did not. There were some question marks raised over the weekend about the $500 million of persons who were at high risk, essential workers who make, I believe, 300% of poverty level. I'm trying to remember the exact number. Yep. And who qualify for up to $2,000 of this $500 million. And the governor vetoed a section of it that established a commission that created some accountability associated with the distribution of funds. So, I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, you know, it's the governor decided he didn't want another relatively large commission, I won't lie, it was like 28 people,
yep,
to essentially look over the shoulder a bit and help establish the guidelines of how to establish this type of program. So, you know, he whacked it out. We're not going to be able to override it because the session is closed unless the speaker decides to call us in for a special session. I don't think this rises to that level. But then again, I've been wrong. I can't predict what the speaker is going to do. I don't know if it's rises to the level the speaker feels as to bring us all back during the holiday period for an override. But I, you would have to ask the speaker. I'm not feeling like there's an urge to. So some other minor issues, he, you know, did some language rewrites here and there. Nothing that really affects most of us in a day-to-day world. It's a lot of technical stuff. And otherwise, you know, our money's intact, and I would expect the administration to start moving the money out as soon as possible, as soon as to get their ducks in order on the distribution and getting the comptroller's office, you know, moving those checks out.
Yeah. Any changes to the Quincy allocation? I know we talked about some of the agencies that would benefit. Any additions or subtractions that you're aware of?
No. It is pretty much the way it looks as we see it in the ARPA funds. You know, so, you know, city has done extremely well, you know, over $2 million worth of earmarks, all one time, all capital, no continuous programs. That is a condition that was basically flat out told to us by leadership. that no reoccurring programs. There is no money here for reoccurring programs.
Yeah, so it's a one-time hit. Yep.
One and done. So, the city did very well, and we obviously went big or we went home. So, like I said, we got some money for dredging, stuff for Square Point Park, some money for Thomas Crane Library roof, a number of different projects that need to happen. We'll look for disbursements to come out.
Yeah, the mayor mentioned that Quincy Center T Station may benefit. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, the Quincy Center T Station's master planner is actually the city of Quincy. That was a transportation bond bill piece that feels like a lifetime ago. Yep. That we did that. And there's about $50 million-ish or so that's going to be dedicated to the city on doing so. We actually allocated some bond money in the past as well to give the money to the city to help do the master planning. The reality is, do a true redevelopment of Quincy Center T Station is upwards of $500 million. Mm. So obviously it's MBTA, which means it's, belongs to the T, which indirectly belongs to the state. Again, the MBTA is a quasi-public agency, which is kind of weird critter in state government. So, I don't think the MBTA is going to be able to completely bond a project on their own. They're going to need a combination of other assistance, both federal, state, their own budget. And we'll see if the city wants to kick in anything on their own as well. But again, the city's getting some state money to do some planning. So city's not kicking anything in at the moment. It's not a knock. It is what it is, folks. So be mindful of the fact that, the city is getting a lot of state benefits here. And largely thanks to the speaker and not to pat ourselves on the back, but the delegation actually works pretty well together. We don't fight each other. I know delegations to fight each other. It's different, very different work dynamics.
Yeah, it certainly benefits the city when everybody gets along.
No, absolutely. There is none of that backroom drama. And I've been around and seen a lot of delegations come and go around the state. And, I've seen the backroom drama. That's one of the benefits of having us around in the sense that, kind of know each other. We know how each other behaves. We understand each other's priorities and learning how to get along over the many years. And, obviously I've known these folks, John and John Keenan and Bruce Ayers and the speaker, years before I even came into office. So my adjustment was actually fairly easy when I showed up, largely because I worked with all of them in different capacities in my previous life. So, a happy delegation is actually very beneficial for the constituencies because our constituencies do not need to have something gummed up because one of our egos are bruised.
Congress may take a lesson from that.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I also know delegations on both Democrats and Republicans with it. And they work just fine. The issue is not these and ours. The issue is you. I think it's a way to put it.
That doesn't mean unenrolled either.
No, actually not. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's really about individual personality issues and how they try to get along. And, that is the more important and challenging component rather than political affiliation. And Congress, I know, is very much divided political affiliation, but also internally, there's a lot of different personalities and just trying to find out a way for everyone to work together through their own personalities themselves. As we all know, you don't really get to pick your coworkers, especially in this business. And you got to figure out how to make work. And same thing on a committee level. I chair a committee and I have a total, including myself, 11 House members and there's 6 Senate members. And, there's a co-chair. I didn't appoint to be my co-chair and she didn't appoint me to be my co-chair. So we had to learn how to get along and it takes a bit of time. And then just, again, we're back in a virtual format. The inability to have a meal together for almost 7 months since our appointments to actually have a face-to-face meeting and actually talk about stuff together in life. So we get a feel of where we've been and where we're going.
Right.
I can't express how important that is.
It's a people business. Yeah, absolutely. We can talk a little bit about the pandemic. What do you think about the free rapid at-home COVID-19 tests that the state's giving out?
Yeah, 2.1 million test kits has been bought by the governor for the home rapid test kits. You've probably seen them at CVS and Walgreens already. I think they're somewhere between $40 and $60 a piece. City Queens is getting, 19,000 or so.
Right.
It's being distributed based on income need. So, you know, different, it's basically going to be based off the census calculation of median household income and census blocks. So, you know, every community is managing the recipient of these tests differently. I believe there are two tests per kit.
Yes.
Again, I mean, I wouldn't just open it up right away when you get home and do a test kit. I mean, you should have some awareness of whether you had any exposure to before you go forward. Although Omicron creates an interesting scenario where, you know, original COVID was about potentially five days-ish at incubation. Delta kind of kept it to closer to 3 to 5 days. Omicron seems to cut that time in half,
yep.
It appears, to under 3 days with symptoms of, you know, and symptomatic. When you're symptomatic, you're very, very contagious.
Yep.
But asymptomatic, you are also contagious. But until you're symptomatic, you don't know if you're contagious.
Right. Yeah, so you don't limit your exposure to anybody because you think you're fine.
It's a very confusing situation because, asymptomatic, you can still transmit, but you're feeling fine. But if you're fully symptomatic, you're just full-blown transmissible,
mm-hmm.
because the sheer number of respiratory fluids coming in your body when you're sick. So, you know, you got to figure it out. And the reason to test kits, again, is that you may end up with a false and a positive, and then you better go outside and get a PRC test if that's the case.
Right.
So I'm hoping that people are going to use this wisely in terms of, you know, circumstances. But I think it's very important people have one at home as a precaution, especially during the holiday season, where everyone's traveling and people are trying to get their shopping done in person and people seeing family. As I said earlier, with my own staff, while taking enormous precautions before seeing family.
Sure. Yeah, I know the governor's talked about hopefully arranging with the test manufacturers to get a reduced rate in the future so they'd be more readily available.
Yeah, supply and demand issue. I mean, you know, again, we talk about supply chain a lot. Even the cardboard boxes for these test kits are premium right now because cardboard's been used for test kits all over the world. And it's actually impacted things like boxes for beer, right? Things I deal with in my committee world. So we'll see, you know, if he can't get the price down. I mean, the cost of doing business is going up everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely not driven by just wages, because obviously, you know, people try to find work, try to get help for workers, but also the product themselves, because the current circumstances dictate that certain products have certain priorities over others.
Yeah. We're seeing, you know, Fenway Park reopened now for a vaccination clinic again for boosters. Are we taking a step backwards, do you think, Stacky?
Well, people have been very good in boosters so far. Ever since the governor announced, CDC announced that, you know, everyone over 18, I mean, I think we're over 1.7 million doses of boosters provided.
Yes.
Statewide, we're 83% one dose, with 73% two dose. So we're at 5 million people fully vaccinated two dose. Obviously, Omicron has changed everything. And even though people's antibodies have declined over time, you know, the question, again, I say over and over, is your memory cells sufficiently remembering how to combat COVID if it shows up at your doorstep, for lack of a better term?
Right.
We don't know that. And it's something that the government and healthcare providers and scientists and immunologists, and frankly, including myself, is not willing to test that theory if your body has learned how to deal with COVID, as opposed to let's just get more antibodies and try to stop this thing before we find out if your body can handle it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the mystery situation that we'd rather not risk, right? I mean, if only half the population's body's memory cells remember how to deal with COVID, and the other half can't remember what to deal with COVID for whatever reasons, because your body can't remember, you know, at least that 50% of the population suddenly vaccinated overnight. Right.
Yeah.
You know, they'll get infected. So we don't know. And, you know, this becomes a real world test situation that, frankly, we can't test. So, you know, please do get your booster. You know, 1.7 people have been able to get their appointments done. I do know that Manatee Community Health Center is still taking appointments at the Crown Colony location, 180 Crown Colony. So get online to Manatee Community Health Center's website, CVS and Walgreens. I mean, I got my booster November 22nd. I just hunted around and got my booster Moderna at the CVS on Gallup Boulevard. It was the closest one available to me. You know, obviously check your doctor's offices. And if you're under any kind of care, like my mother is, who has to go to oncology, you know, she was able to, you know, get an appointment via her oncologist to get a booster shot. So No, and definitely, keep in mind that if you're older, much older, or you're immune compromised or have things like cancer or organ transplants, whatnot, your risk is still very high. But the vaccine reduces the risk of severe illness and death. I mean, not guaranteeing it will, by the way. I mean, a lot of folks that have died of COVID-19 with vaccination, unfortunately had other complications associated with it. And not everybody dies from COVID-19 if they have other complications. Other complications can override the fact that you just happen to have COVID at the same time. It's just COVID adds more challenges with an existing condition. So again, please do get your booster. I know it's challenging to find a location right now, but definitely use so. So it's not a supply problem, it's a scheduling problem. Opening up Fenway will hopefully alleviate the scheduling issue, and we can get more shots in people's arms. But given the fact that we're at 83% single shot and 73% and climbing a second shot in 5 million people, two shot vaccination, it's an indication again. I think Massachusetts people and the whole are very aware of what's going on, and it shows a sign that we're ahead of the curve of the rest of the country.
Yeah, the state's website is a great resource as well, because there are still some state-sponsored vaccination clinics in the area. Folks can check those as well. And then you're obviously, as you mentioned, your chain pharmacies, your doctor's offices, Stop and Shop, I think, is still offering them, some Walmarts as well. So there's resources. You just got to hunt a little bit.
Yes, and also again, if you had a tough time on the second shot, if you got Pfizer, Moderna, I'll make a little time for this as well. I know we're in the holiday season, but perhaps the holidays is not a bad time to do it. A lot of people will still take time off during the holiday period, and frankly, unless you're in retail, most of our jobs get a little slower during this time period as well. So, maybe this is a good time to, for people to try to take care of that. And again, you still have an activation period, which is about 2+ weeks activation. So, it's not like you get your shot that day and suddenly you're instantly receiving all those antibodies. Your body will build it up, and of course, as we found out, you do tend to not feel so good after the shot, as your body is now generating all these new antibodies. So, and Omicron is frightening right now because Omicron is actually doubling the speed of Delta. So Delta doubled Alpha. Alpha doubled the original. So if you can picture it this way. The spread rate for Alpha was twice the original. Then we had a series of other letters that never materialized to be a dominant strain. Then Delta showed up, which is twice as fast as Alpha, which is twice as fast as original. Now you got Omicron, which is now twice as fast as Delta, which is twice as fast as Alpha, which is twice as fast as the original. So, we're definitely well into chickenpox infection level territory. And next thing down the pipe is measles level. Measles is the most contagious, transmission of diseases out there is measles. So it's slowly but steadily heading to a measles territory, which is actually kind of frightening. The United Kingdom, the British are projecting that it's going to be the dominant strain probably by end of Christmas, where things are going. 40% of all positive results has been Omicron. They're the highest levels of infection rate they've seen since January of this year. The British are really now have to really consider about whether or not they're going to impose new stricter measures. Again, they already voted in House of Commons to start limiting movements and reinstating things like mask mandates. But individual mayors and the provincial governors and whatnot, and well, I think the county government as well. So they got to start making some quick decisions as we head to the holidays about whether they're going to really start shutting things down to slow the spread rate. Now, does Omicron kill you faster? Well, we're not sure. The answer seems to be no, because Delta and Alpha don't make you die faster because it still does the same thing as it always does. It's a respiratory disease that kills your lung cells, which lets all this bacteria into your body, and that kills you. But the spread rate is the concern. So, I mean, even though it may not have the more of a killer, but the fact it incubates faster, makes you sick faster, and it's more transmissible, increases the odds of more people, especially unvaccinated people, to get the disease, and has that impact. And you explained to me that the perfect storm is that if Omicron hits a height in terms of its exponential rise, which also means exponential sickness, which means that you're going to have all these folks that could be ill, and then we have a workforce shortage. It's like the perfect storm for everything shutting down. Well, us actually doing anything to close it down from the government level will close down naturally because you're going to have people sick or quarantined for up to 2 weeks. And then that has a huge impact on our workforce, which is already strained, especially at the low wage levels that have higher customer facing contact.
Okay. Oh, fun stuff ahead of Christmas.
Well, it's, yeah, that was what was framed to me, that that is like the perfect storm.
Yeah.
It is like, that is the perfect storm. So again, I'm not discouraging people from going out. I do encourage people to, you know, exercise a high degree of caution. I mean, I do try to limit my movements around places that have a high quantity of people. Even then, you know, people see me with my mask on and continue to do the basic we talked about, sanitation, mask, and try to keep a distance and be conscious of others around you. I mean, this ain't that hard. I mean, it's the same message we've been talking about for a year and a half now, or a year and 9 months. So the message hasn't changed. It's whether people want to follow through on what I consider very low-hanging fruit in life. You know, it's up to you to decide how you're going to manage that. I can't make you wash your hands.
Let's talk about eggs.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I saw the Globe article, too. So eggs, yeah.
Eggmageddon, I think they're calling it.
Sounds like something McDonald's is going to put out soon.
Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah.
Eggmageddon muffin. Eggmageddon sandwiches. Eggmageddon muffin sandwiches. Eggmageddon on a croissant.
There you go. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, the voters voted some years back now, I think 4 years now, to have a minimum humane standards for eggs and pork that come into Massachusetts for consumption. And a lot of this stuff was going to be fully implemented January 1st of this year. The House and Senate each passed bills. They're pretty much the same to move out the date of implementation, but more importantly, change the standard pursuant ballot question to modern humane standards, which the Humane Society and other agricultural groups, as well as animal advocates, have all agreed upon is the proper way of humane treatment of chickens. And this has been a long process for the entire egg industry to change their methods on better animal care for chickens. So now they've adopted a multi-tier, basically vertical containment system for the chickens, which provides them a lot more space, but doesn't meet the exact size pursuant to the ballot question. But there is consensus, you know, among animal advocates that this is the best way to treat chickens and to obviously, you know, keep the animals happy as much as possible. I mean, you know, we eat them. I mean, there is an end goal to these animals. You know, we're going to, you know, want to adopt these new standards. So we have a continued flowing of egg supply in Massachusetts. The sticking point is the House wants to do a delay on the pork component. According to the Globe, about 50% of the pork industry has upgraded their standards to more humane standards advocates have been asking for, and the industry has agreed upon as they kind of, you know, do the capital upgrades. The other half of the industry hasn't quite reached it yet. So we want to do another delay for them to let the other half of the industry catch up. So some of you say, well, screw the other half of the industry, don't worry about it. Well, if you don't eat meat, that's great. But for the rest of us that, you know, seem to like bacon and sausage and Christmas hams, this is a problem, because if we lose 50% of your supply chain, which we've all experienced supply chain, folks, problem supply chain, obviously the other half of the equation that can provide us pork will just jack up their price. It isn't hard. So we want to try to avoid a spike in pork prices. We really should give the industry more time to catch up, because it isn't a matter of them not doing it. It's just they need to, you know, catch up is what's going on. It's major capital improvements to these facilities. The egg issue is a lot more pressing in the sense that we will have no eggs. That's just the bottom line, everybody.
Yeah, so that's something you can stockpile either.
No. I mean, if you got like 5 cartons of eggs in your fridge, then, you know, more power to you. it would greatly limit the supply of eggs. We'll probably reduce it to a very small number of providers in Massachusetts. And no big surprise, supply and demand, those egg prices will jack up huge. If we go to a very, very, very small number of suppliers. And the conference committee has the bill, and hopefully the conference committee will get something out before the year's end, because it has to be done by January 1st next year. And the you know, the governor will sign it. There's really no doubt he wants to avoid Eggmageddon. But
I just picture a black market for eggs if this doesn't happen.
You're the board in New Hampshire. You're in New Hampshire water picking up your eggs.
There'll be New Hampshire egg stores instead of liquor stores.
The Boston Globe's following legislators up to New Hampshire. If you understand that joke, you know what article I'm talking about.
Yes.
Taking pictures of license plates and the visuals of Representative Chan on the egg buy. Corner market in New
Hampshire. Pop that trunk open. It's full of eggs.
I think we're just giving some people some ideas we really shouldn't put in their heads.
I guess that's, yeah, we probably shouldn't.
Also, good luck finding a moving van. I mean, all the transport vehicles have been gobbled up by FedEx and Amazon delivery services for the holidays. There's been a massive rental or purchase of transportation vehicles just to get those deliveries to your door right now.
So, yes, I have seen, you know, U-Haul trucks galore everywhere I go. So, yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, if you're going to try to do egg smuggling, just to let you know, you're going to have to borrow your mom's or dad's car, neighbor's car.
Maybe your kid's bicycle with a basket or something.
Yeah, I have that image of this massive caravan of passenger vehicles trying to get eggs and then black market it down here. And then you have the bacon black market, which, you know, who can't live without bacon, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's already expensive. So, yeah.
Yeah, and food prices are average, depending on what product you look at. I mean, if you took the total average, I think it's closing in between up to 6%, depending on what part of the state you're in and what part of the country you're in. So, I mean, food prices are very, very much growing. And we also actually, interesting, people forgot, we actually did have a supply chain problem with eggs last year. Avian flu took hold in the midst of the height of pandemic last year. And people forgot about that. And it actually resulted in egg price doubling because of, unfortunately, avian flu. I mean, it's not good. I mean, you don't want sick chickens coming to the public. But also, unfortunately, these chickens do kind of die of avian flu in large numbers. And, you know, inoculation, all that, trying to, you know, keep the chickens safe from each other. Sounds kind of like COVID-19, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yeah.
So we've already experienced a doubling of prices last year on eggs from the avian flu. And it was a global phenomenon. It wasn't just limited to the United States on that. There was that wave of flu. So imagine that compounded by the fact that there is almost no supplier that meets the ballot questions language. You make the avian flu impact look minuscule compared to the price of eggs that show up in the beginning of the year.
All right, so let's hope there is an agreement and a change soon.
Yeah, I hope so too. During the pandemic, I've consumed more eggs than I've consumed my whole life. It's just an easy protein source to make for lunch or breakfast, and even snack in the middle, because these Zoom meetings has resulted in kind of like scheduling back to back to back to back.
Sure.
Much more so than in person, where you can kind of like schedule in 15-minute breaks, whatnot, because of people's very interesting, very tight schedules on Zoom with folks on meetings. It just goes back to back to back. Very different from in person, back to back to back.
Yes, very much so. You're right. I agree with that, because there's not the socializing factor before and after the meetings. You know, you're in it, then you're out of it, then you're in it again.
Yeah. And, I've had people have tolerated me trying to eat lunch while running meeting at the same time, or people pop in and can I bend your ear for 15 minutes? Like, if you're willing to watch me eat, you can bend your ear, my ear, as much as you want, but don't keep you from lunch. this is still a lifestyle that, you know, a year and 9 months in is still very challenging on operations, even though you're working from home. It's just the way the rapid pace of this type of format, you know, actually is not actually good for my lifestyle for the most part.
Yeah, for a workaholic, it's deadly, because you just can't pull yourself away from it. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So
interestingly, I know there's money in the ARPA bill for things like mental health, behavioral health programs to help people cope with the stress that's been created through this pandemic.
Yeah, it put some one-time money. I think it's close to $150 million when all said and done towards mental health services, especially COVID-related, one-time boosting of the mental health industry for next 5 or so years. to deal with COVID and other COVID impacts. And obviously has a huge impact on children, not just because not going to school, but, you know, stress life at home and everyone trying to make everything work. And, you know, we've all heard stories of couples spending more time with them than ever since they were started dating. And, you know, this type of lifestyle change does affect all of us. And I'm not immune to that as well. A lot of my socialization actually comes from the office, like many of us. And I do care about my staff and want to know what's going on in their lives. And, other people I see on the street is a big part of just saying hello. And, you know, everyone's a little bit grumpier at some level. I'm also discovering because they can't go, you know, enjoy their vacations like they normally would. They can't have the family outings like they normally would. I know people are working and trying in the summer and social distancing and the Cape, but there's always that little bit of a concern in everyone's mind, I think, about, you know, did I run across somebody that could have been infected? And, you know, was there an incidental situation? And that, you know, was very human nature. It's normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about the Fed considering raising interest rates next year, Tacky?
Well, I also thought like the Fed that inflation wasn't that big a deal as
past. Right. They were telling us just it's temporary, you know, it'll be over soon. Apparently not so temporary.
No, I was actually under that impression as well. Most people look at inflation that you look at school as an overprinting of money. That is how it's normally taught. That you print so much money, the value is the dollar. So people look at countries like Italy and everywhere in Africa and, you know, big parts of South America, where the local government solution to wealth problem is to just print more money because it creates more wealth. Well, that isn't how it works, right? More money is to create more wealth. But the United States still being the biggest economy in the world, I mean, our GDP has actually grown this year quite a bit. And our overall economic growth has been exceeding 4% and higher. Has resulted in people's wages not meeting the price of supply chain, essentially, cost of doing business. And it's actually a perfect storm of needing increased wages, plus also price increases on product, not driven by wages entirely, actually driven by supply chain and demand and supply. And prior to COVID, we all discovered how we enjoyed so much on demand, meaning that if you needed something, it was always readily available. And the hospital system is an example of that, where they didn't stockpile that much because if they needed it, they ordered it, it showed up perhaps that day or the next morning.
Yeah.
And, given the fact that, you know, I don't know, COVID can shut down a whole factory. It has an impact on getting supplies. So now, of course, essential service businesses are stockpiling. Because of COVID. And if they don't have those supplies, you could die. Not just incubators, but all the medications and whatnot to help treat diseases. So it's a very changed mentality going on here, particularly in healthcare. But, you know, in our day-to-day normal lives, what you thought you could get tomorrow morning, for example, like we talked about eggs, but, you know, also things like soup. Has changed how they're manufactured because, again, I mean, everyone's preparing for an impossibility to have a large employee reduction because of COVID. And some people have left the workplace completely. Retirements are at all-time high through all sectors. People who are doing front-face jobs are now filling those jobs with those people that have been retired that aren't front-face. Unemployment nationally is at 4.2%, which, you know, makes it a workers' market. The lower the unemployment, the workers have more supply chain, demand and supply benefit works for workers when the unemployment's low, so it forces wages up. But inflation means the products are going up too. So this isn't a situation where we overprinted money in the sense that our money's been devalued, because if you look at the U.S. dollar globally, the U.S. dollar is extremely strong right now.
Yes.
Very strong, despite inflation. Inflation should devalue our money, but that's not the case right now. It's actually quite non-economic book thing. I mean, normally the expectation is that, you know, so-called textbook situation, that isn't occurring here. And this is really a baffling situation overall. The Fed's dumping a whole lot of money to the economy, and it's not just benefits, but, you know, boosting up the hotel industry, the restaurant industries, the retail industry, the airlines. I mean, you know, the Fed's, you know, dumped a lot of money. People only think about the unemployment checks. No, it's more than just unemployment checks.
Oh, yeah.
They dump billions of dollars into a lot of industries all through all sectors as much as they could. not every sector, as much sectors as they could to keep the economy bolstered, trying to prevent a recession, which actually we did prevent a recession through that. And now we've got the Fed transportation money, which again will create more jobs, again, to bolster against potential recession. They've created inflation unintentionally. So last summer, I was kind of like, well, you know, the money, increased printing of money hasn't changed the value of the dollar, and it's caused a temporary inflation. But it turns out it's not the printing of money. It's the entire economy impacted by COVID is impacting our entire cost of living, more so than ever. And, you know, people always thought bigger is better. Well, in the U.S. economy, we want to keep the economy at 2 or 3% at all time to avoid inflation. You know, we're growing at over 4%. You know, at one point, it was close to 7% growth per month. And that drives inflation. So no, bigger isn't better in the U.S. economy. A modest growth stems inflation. So, you know, people look at Japan, for example, and, you know, they have very little inflation. The yen doesn't shift against the dollar too much. The U.S. dollar is much stronger than the yen right now, despite there's no massive inflation in Japan. Japan's a little different because they don't increase wages. They have very, very small wage stagnation. As a result, it forces industry to keep prices artificially low.
Yes. Yeah.
But also they're having energy costs go up. They're having supply chains costs go up. We'll see how long they can maintain lower retail prices, because if products brought in overseas or energy prices go up, as we're seeing here, and they're experiencing the same thing, will that cause retailers to increase their prices? But if you have stagnated wages, meaning that you can't pay for the increased prices associated retail increases, you know, that then you have people buy less and you now initiate a recession.
Right. Yeah.
Or actually deflation. Sorry. It's really called deflation.
Yeah.
So because people buy less, the prices go up, you know, start deflation. The value of dollar goes down a lot. So in this case, the yen goes down a lot. So, I mean, you know, we obviously are not the Japanese market, very different market, but we're all subject to the same stresses of import export and also the same stresses around of energy.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. It will be good for investments and people's savings.
Yeah, the Feds are thinking about maybe three interest hikes next year. They're kind of vague about what those interest hikes look like. Right now, borrowing is, again, at all-time low, looking like 2008 all-time low interest rates. The World Banks and other banks around the world are looking at the same situation we're in, trying to see if they're going to do inflation of interest rates. The Feds are watching carefully as well as they're watching us. Everyone's watching each other. Because we're a global economy and interest rates does affect foreign investment, mm-hmm. Going both directions, not just people investing in the U.S., but also investing overseas, and whether or not, you know, we're going to look at saving more money to try to slow this economy down. So, I mean, people have realized CDs are pretty much useless at the moment.
Stuffing it under the mattress. It's basically the same thing.
So, you know, the question really comes come next year, if there is an interest rate hike, the markets generally will respond with a bit of a decline. I don't think it's going to be a free fall by any stretch, but we'll see how it plays out. So, yeah, I think people should, you know, now I hope hopefully people listening realize exactly how integrated our economies globally, how integrated our economies locally. And how you open your wallet actually has a ripple effect through the whole economy.
Absolutely does. It's so true. Definitely. What do you hear in the political circles, Tacky, with the governor's recent announcement that they won't be running again? Anything you can share with us?
Oh, Sonia Chang Diaz just left me a message on my phone while talking to you.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead and play that for us so we can hear it.
People are looking for endorsements, right? We talked about, you know, I don't have to endorse if I don't feel like it. And, you know, I can if I want. But, I mean, the two gorillas in the room in the Democratic primary, and quite frankly, in Massachusetts politics is right now Maura Healey and Marty Walsh. I mean, yep. You guys all read the papers and watch the news. It's not like it's a big secret. And, you know, Maura Healey and Marty Walsh are going to have quite a bit of time trying to figure what they want to do, because if both of them get into the room together, you know, it's not just the size of their bank account, but both of them have various degrees of name recognition around the state, and also campaign mechanisms, meaning they have legitimate ability to create, you know, statewide campaign machines, which can be an interesting, you know, watching two very large, powerful politicians in terms of campaign capacity going at your Democratic primary. And if that happens, you'll probably see a very fascinating split, particularly as part of the Democratic Convention caucuses. I know this is real inside baseball. Mostly really just don't care. But, you know, the caucuses as well as the convention votes are interesting because of geography. So if a certain a certain different percentage of caucus voters, you know, originally longtime, tend to be longtime Democrats, I want to say it's always the case, but tend to be, you know, reflects the political ideology changes within the party itself. And the ideology will sometimes follow the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see if there is a big, two big campaigners in the room, they both have different ideologies and platforms, where did the caucus delegates vote are going to be. And again, it's very inside baseball, but it gives me a sense of, you know, where the Democratic votes are in Quincy and the general region. I know it's a very microcosm look, but it's things I do look at and gives me an idea what's going on in the state. Neither one's made a commitment at the moment. I know Marty Walsh was in Springfield this week regarding a rail from Springfield to Boston, but he's not the transportation secretary.
No.
Should we be into that? Maybe, maybe yes, maybe no.
Interesting. Of course, he represented part of Quincy for a short time.
For a whole breath of a minute. He was mayor of Boston before he finished representing Quincy. We're pushing Dan Hunt back over the bridge. So he's no longer part of the speaker's delegation. You know, we go to say, well, part of the speaker's delegation. He can't do that now. That goes in effect next year. So Dan Hunt, we thank you for your time, and good luck back in Boston. what?
So parochial around here, we really are.
Well, I'm just as parochial as anybody else in this city. Don't make that mistake, folks. I have the same attitude as most of the folks in this city regarding Quincy and Boston. So we'll see. I mean, time is running out. Nomination papers should float out somewhere around Valentine's Day-ish. Obviously, I need to get my own signatures done. I'm not worried about their signatures. I'd rather get my own done first. And, you know, that means they got essentially 6 weeks to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Before first papers come out. They obviously can get papers after February 14th and, you know, declare it later. But I think it's important for, particularly in a COVID campaign, potentially an Omicron campaign, you know, you got to get your infrastructure lined up quickly. And, you know, we're still waiting out. And, you know, my friends and other places to get information from in politics, you know, tell me that there is active talk in the Marty camp about infrastructure and whether they can put one together fast enough. And, you know, he has $5 million. Don't get me wrong, money's important in politics, but you got no boots in the ground. The money also becomes useless. So if Marty's infrastructure can be assembled quickly enough, and he is serious about running, and this is a state that did very well for Joe Biden, including the city of Boston and other areas, you know, it could be very exciting. And the question is, you know, are there going to be two of them or just one of them? Maura Healey is kind of same position. She's a sitting attorney general. So she's got to make a decision if she wants to run for governor, because it's already people lining up running for attorney general in Democratic primary right now, anticipating her exit. And the flip side, some reason everybody wants to be lieutenant governor, which I still don't get. I mean, John Kerry was the last one to make lieutenant governor into anything useful post-lieutenant governor career. People are jumping this opportunity thinking that it will lead them somewhere else, which I still baffles my mind.
Well, it worked for Jane Swift for a short time.
And Paul Cellucci for a short time. But again, exceptions to the rule, right?
Right.
And if you're acting governor, generally gives you a head start for a campaign.
Yep.
So the other speculations, Karen Pulido, people fully expected her to run for governor. She had a big enough campaign war chest going. And, you know, her exit with the governor simultaneously, particularly for a person who still has a lot of campaign fire in the belly, it looks like, you know, what is she going to do with all that money if she's not running for governor? So we don't know what Karen Polito is doing. It actually creates a lot of interesting questions also that, well, in terms of political rumors. But, you know, I think by beginning of the year, hopefully for Democrats, we have a clearer picture of what's going to go on with both Marty Walsh and Maura Healey. If you're a Republican, you know, obviously Jeff Deal was out there, but don't expect Jeff Deal to sit on the ballot alone. I mean, our former colleague, Sean O'Connell, because he was also Jeff Deal's colleague, we all came in the office together as reps, you know, is looking for a run of governor. And I don't think it'll be over yet. I think the Republican side of the fence, you know, is actually looking for also some diversity of political ideology and approach to government on their side as well. Like Democrats, it's not one size fit all. So I think there are a number of Republicans out there that probably could be novices to politics in the sense that they never ran for political office before, much like Baker when he ran the first time against Deval Patrick. You know, you may potentially see in the Republican side another newcomer that is able to rally the Republican base at some level, as well as unenrolled or Republican-leaning voters in Massachusetts. So stay tuned. I think it could be very exciting as we close into February, the number of names swirling around in the mill for both both camps.
All right. Something to look forward to. In the meantime, how do we reach out to you, Tacky?
Well, you're going to reach out at 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. We check the voicemail. It does work properly. Smash a button and get to a staffer, leave a message, and we'll do our best to get back to you. We actually do get your voicemails by email now. It actually comes in as audio waves. So don't worry about us checking voicemail. The system automatically sends us files of your audio. So do speak clearly, because if you can't, we don't know who you are.
Right.
And obviously tell us how to find you. We're discovering that now, too. People don't seem to want to tell us how to get back to you. It's like one of those simple things about leaving a phone number on your phone. You can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. But again, I remind folks, I had received a lot of email. I received over 1,100 emails,
wow,
counting on the Body Works bill that we heard on Monday, and those were in opposition of the bill. So I'll give you an idea of the volume I'm trying to navigate through an email, but definitely, you know, feel the need if you have to, just be aware, I got to find it, for lack of a better term. Obviously, tackingchat.org, we provide some phone numbers. We really need to do some website updates, honestly. I looked at it the other day. We got to get around to that during the holidays, but you know, get some information out there. And State Representative Tacky Chan at Facebook. Again, you do not have to be a Facebook user to look at my Facebook account. It is a public site. We post our public hearings up there, you know, some useful information they may find, you know, maybe helpful to you. And, you know, every so often, whenever I do go to an event, you know, you see my face out there on the Facebook page. But, you know, we've been using it primarily as a resource and also to create a degree of transparency regarding my public hearings and executive sessions. So, you know, many ways to find information that you may not need to contact me, but, you know, if you do, we'll do our best to try to help you out.
All right. Next week, I want to see you in a Santa hat, Tacky. And give it your best ho, ho, ho.
Well, I can't promise you a Santa hat, but we can share some other old stories from my younger days about Christmas. How's that sound?
Oh, okay. That's something to look forward to. All right. appreciate it. Good to talk to you as always.
Always good to talk to you, Joe, and I'll see you in a week.